defend. At least by land, you only have to defend.
Well, there are all these military schools were there as well. So
that's right.
There was quite a presence.
That's right. You have the guys in the black pajamas there at the training center.
Yes, you wouldn't want to ruin any VC R&R area.
That's right.
Places
that's either. That's the other consideration. Yeah. That's right.
And of course, the thing is, you weren't there long after Tet before you had to go back.
Yeah.
What was your after Tet? Was there any vibe you picked up in the aftermath? And did you ever get back to the IVS headquarters out by the airport?
After Tet?
Yeah.
Yeah. I sure did. Well, what happened was, for a long time, Sally and I were just holed up in this compound, and we weren't able to reach anybody at IVS because they had all bailed out of there, I guess. And I think Mark Lynch actually was, at some point, was dispatched or dispatched himself to come look for Sally because she was unaccounted for. I guess I wasn't unaccounted for because I was assumed to be in Vung Tau, I guess, at that point. And when we could, we finally made phone contact. And then a day or two later, we after things had settled down, we went back. Link back up with the rest of IBS, especially so that they could respond accurately to questions about who was where. And but the Tet Offensive itself was very, I mean, everybody has their own Tet stories, and for me, I mean, the revelation, I mean, it wasn't much of a revelation, but to we were of necessity thrown into close quarters with a whole mix of different people, each with their own perspectives on the war itself, and on in particular on what was going on at that point. And you know, the contrast in perspectives was actually remarkable. We had there was a real kind of ass of a colonel who was in charge of this compound from the American side during the day, and his, you know, when I went and I went to him first when we were trying, you know, I went across the street to this to try to get into this place when there were armored personnel carriers basically pulling up and soldiers are, you know, leaping out. I thought, man, you know, this is real dangerous. And I went to the gate and I asked the Vietnamese guard in Vietnamese if I could use the telephone. I don't know why. I mean, just to say something, because, you know, I had to explain my presence there. And, you know, he was completely mystified. And I finally explained that I was an American and I needed to talk to the American in charge. And I was taken to this colonel. And then later on, I brought Sally back over when I, you know, when the coast was clear. But I was taken to this colonel who was up on the roof looking at the war. And he was on a walkie-talkie or a radio or something with some guy in Tonsnit or something, trying to explain what was going on. He said, oh, it's no problem. We have things under control here. And I'm looking, and there's nothing under control there. And I'm thinking, this guy is in real denial about what's happening here. To me, you know, it was startling to see the war really taking place in Saigon. I mean, you know, fighting really going on. And I was thinking to myself, this is a turning point in this war. Whatever happens here, you know, the fighting has now arrived in the cities. I didn't know that what was going on around the rest of the country, but I knew here it was happening right here in Saigon. And this guy was saying, you know, no big deal. It's under control. Meanwhile, he left. I mean, they had regular working hours, I guess, and he left the day shift, and another colonel, American colonel, came in the evening, who was a much more sensible guy, real savvy kind of a guy. He'd been with the, I think he'd been with a tank battalion in Korea, and he said, you know, we would talk about it, and he would say, you know, this is serious. Something is changing here. We never thought that this kind of thing could possibly happen. So I was hearing what sounded to me like a more realistic appraisal. And so that was just an example of how, you know, talking to different people, you'd have the daytime colonel saying, well, we have our perimeter very well secured here. We don't have to worry about our compound. Then I go talk to the Vietnamese, who were actually in charge of maintaining the perimeter. There was a lieutenant. And he said, we're vulnerable, you know. So again, you know, perspectives completely at odds. And I was, you know, and this Vietnamese lieutenant, I mean, as we got to know him, it was even more interesting, because then he opened up, as he figured he could, I guess we got to know each other and we could all trust one another. And he said, you know, I have a brother who's fighting on the other side. And it would be almost as easy for me to be on the other side as the side I'm on. This is kind of an accident. You know, my wife works with Air France, and, you know, we're trying to, we're trying to have a life, basically. Although, I guess in those days, we didn't even have that term necessarily.
Right.
But so I'm doing my thing with, you know, I'm a lieutenant in the Vietnamese Army, and my wife's a stewardess there in France, and we're just trying to make ends meet, you know, trying to get through this. But I don't have any deep, sort of deep-seated patriotic feelings about the government that I'm serving. I have a brother on the other side. We both feel like, you know, we're Vietnamese and we're patriots, but we happen to be on opposite sides, and it's not, there's no real animosity about, I mean, it was hard for me. I was trying to think about the Civil War, our own Civil War. You know, people, families, I mean, you hear that there were families who were similarly split, and you know how it must be. I mean, to me, it would seem like sort of an agonizing situation to be in. But so the Tet, I guess, I'm trying to answer your question. In the aftermath of Tet, did it mean anything? And I guess to me, it signified that. It was a learning experience for me. You know, just hearing things like this. A lieutenant talk about his own experience with the war and how he sort of fell into what he happened to be doing by accident, by the luck of the draw, and his brother is doing what he's doing, and also just seeing how different people's views of precisely the same fact situation could be. And here we, and these were people who were presumably reporting these on up, and so how mistaken the overall impression of what is happening on the ground must be by the time it filters all the way up to where policy decisions are being made. And, you know, reading Fan's, reading the book about John Paul Fan, Bright Shining Lie, you know, he had that analysis too, that we lose the war if we end up being the ones who fight it.
Just the ultimate irony being that
he
was essentially chief of staff of the
that he
of
ended
a,
up
of a corps.
Exactly. Right. That he ended up, you know, he I guess without realizing it, sort of made the transition to fighting the war. And, you know, regardless of.
But at least that's what Neil Sheehan wants us to.
Well,
to
yeah.
It's a great story.
Well, maybe I don't know. Has there been criticism of that sort?
It's another issue.
Oh,
did,
really?
Were you ever able to keep in touch with any friends you made in Vietnam?
Not very well. No, in fact, not at all. in fact, you know, the way that I had to leave Vietnam was rather sudden. I had sort of talked myself into believing that this draft thing would be handled.
Yeah.
And, you know, that they were idiots back there, and that the wisdom would prevail, and that why would the government spend all this money to send me to Vietnam and then spend a lot more money to take me back? It didn't make, you know.
Can you still make it come back?
No, thanks. You know, I was, of course, naive to think that anything logical was going on when it came to government policy. But
well, speaking about government non-government policy, did you get married?
Yeah.
This is Sally Benson.
Sally Benson, yeah. We got married in 1972.
Uh-huh. Are you still married?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you have an 18-year-old in college.
We have a daughter in college.
Uh-huh. That's great.
But I just wanted to amplify on that answer, because it troubles me that I wasn't able to keep up with my friends there. And, you know, so I had talked myself into basically staying all the full 2 years. And so when I got this telegram come saying, you know, put Nichols on the next plane, and at that point Danny Whitfield was in charge in Saigon, and, you know, he would brook no compromise on this. I said, hey, Danny, I can just go back to Vung Tau. You know, this can take time. You know, getting me on a plane, you know, it's, you know, things don't work that way here, as we all know it. You know, there's lots of red tape. He said, no, you know, I want you out there at the airport, and you know, get the, you know, I've got this telegram that says you got to go, and there was an outstanding draft notice that had to be complied with by, you know, 3 or 4 days hence. So off I went. You know, barely, I didn't go back to Vung Tau and, you know, pack together my things. Basically everything was there. I just had a suitcase with whatever I had. And Sally, you know, didn't even know. I mean, nobody knew that I had left. So I felt, well, this will be temporary. You know, I'll go refuse induction, then I'll come back to Vietnam, and, you know, this won't last long. Well, of course, that turned out to be also equally naive. IVS wasn't about to send me back, you know, for obvious political reasons. Now that I had refused induction, the issue would be, you know, where, it would have been interesting. I would have loved it, actually. The FBI would have had to arrest me in Vietnam, which I would think would be kind of a fun experience. But I didn't. So the upshot was that I sort of yanked out and kept thinking that I would get back somehow, and meanwhile losing touch with people. And then when I went with Don. Don took a trip in '87, group of folks, and that would have been nice to get over to Vung Tau, but it just logistically wasn't possible that trip. And even if I had been able to, you know, would I have been able to find anyone? What
did you think of that trip?
I liked it. I thought it was, I mean, it was just fascinating. It was a real eye-opener, you know, being, you know, first of all, going to North Vietnam and going to these places that I had read about in the history books and so forth. And I thought Don did a pretty good job of, you know, putting everything together, because it was sort of, you had to cobble these things together at that point. And usually the problem that we had was with the local Vietnamese tourist agency thinking that, you know, we wanted this package, when what we really wanted was to get out on our own and see things for ourselves. And so there was this tension, but they tried to accommodate us. I mean, I thought that was good. Although the disaster was the first night in Hanoi, they served us this god awful sort of Eastern European boiled dinner, thinking that, you know, this is what the foreigners would want, and we said no, Vietnamese food, please. And you know, once they got that message, things improved a lot as we got food that we enjoyed. But it was a it was, you know, after having not been there in 20 years, 20 years, it was quite a moving experience for me. And it happened, as it happened, my older brother had died earlier that year, and so there I was going through all kinds of emotions about various things. The trip was very good for me in some ways.
Did you meet other people who had worked with IVS and commented to you about how they felt about IVS after all this?
I'm sure we did. I'm confused, because I know that I've gotten that kind of feedback from other IVSers who've talked to people, and there is a real residue of positive goodwill towards IVS among people in Vietnam and in Laos. We get that feedback from Laos too. I can't remember on that trip. I'm sure we did get together with people who had known IVS earlier, and they clearly were. I think during the last night or second to the last night that we were there, we had there was a little get together where people showed up, and it's a little hazy to me now, but it included folks who knew who had worked with IVSers and knew IVS. So it was gratifying, you know, to know that there was still a continuity of sorts, at least in terms of the remembrance of the experience.
Well, actually, that's since our time is up, that's a good way of ending it.
Yeah, well, it's interesting how this triggers so, you know, many tangents and thoughts that one hasn't had in a while, and it's enjoyable.
Well, it's going to be fun. Well, I'd like to come back to you on some issues, especially about what's going on in IBS. Mm-hmm. We can do that over the phone sometime.
Okay, sure.
And of course, Sally now must speak.
Ah.
And Paul and I always go. We're always in D.C. So, with your permission and with hers.
Well, you don't need my permission.
I know, but
I bet, you do need hers.
I'd love to look you up. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.